Welcome back. My name is Kaz.
This is Medibot.
And this is an episode of the Skulls Cast that is incremented one more than the last one.
Yes. And we took the existing value and use our incrementation operator upon it to get a new value that is then returned.
Indeed, which you can read right above the place where you're listening to this. It probably also appears in the iTunes if you're listening through there, which I'm just trying to stall while I try to remember exactly
it's
how
more
many
than
of these
six.
That we've done.
Definitely more than
now,
six.
No, we've done more than six.
I think that's enough to go
I'm
on.
Reasonably sure that we've done more than six. Anyway, we're going to begin tonight with our segment of Skulls Asked. And after that, continue on with our infinite book review Rise of the Video Game Zinesters. But for starters here, we have a couple of questions that
Enter.
You, the audience, have asked of us. All right,
yes.
So the first question is from listener Hold On Juicely. Despite all the bad rep you give do-nothing enchantments, what are three of your favorite enchantment cards to play, do-nothing or otherwise? They don't necessarily have to be good, just ones you like playing.
You want to go first, or you want me to
go
first?
No, you absolutely
Number
go first.
One, Sunken Hope.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Cowardice.
No, well, I do like Cowardice a lot, and we'll get to that, but if we're going based on, like, what I... empirically, which one... You know, which one do seems to find its way into every deck I build that has islands in it. We have Sunken Hope, which will cost you 3 and 2 blue, and it says, at the beginning of each player's upkeep, that player returns a creature they control to its owner's hand.
Huh.
So it's just this repeated sort of, you know, you gotta keep putting your creatures back in your hand.
You know what the best part of that is? They decided to make an artifact out of that, but make it worse, and call it Blood Clock. So this enchantment has some really powerful names associated with it. I like Blood Clock as a name, and that does pretty much the same thing, only they're allowed to pay life instead of returning the creature.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it gives
them no choices.
Gives them a backdoor out of it.
Bounce a dude.
So you like Sunken Hope. You like
I like Sunken Hope because
Great.
I... like
that's
to bounce things.
That's the answer. Okay, that's one.
Number two, Cowardice.
Okay.
Which also is 3 and 2 blue mana. We see a pattern starting to form and says, whenever a creature becomes the target of a spell or ability, return that creature to its owner's hand.
You're reading this off of cards that are in front of you, aren't you?
No. This is from memory.
Oh.
I know these two cards, at least. Cowardice, again, I like bouncing things. I like bouncing all the things, because I hate getting attacked by creatures, and the best way...
You don't have
to
justify yourself,
all
lady.
Right,
we
number
just,
three...
Now
it actually gets a little hard, because those are my easy two,
yeah,
you
okay,
know,
those are the,
five
the
mana blue, do-nothing enchantments. Maybe you should go while I think of my third.
Well, number one is Oblivion Ring for me. It says no, and it is a removal spell. And it is an enchantment.
I don't think that counts as a do-nothing enchantment. That's a removal spell.
Well, the
spell.
Question said do-nothing or otherwise.
Oh, okay.
It was right there in the question. It's baked into the
question
that he's asking
for
any enchantment. It's the permanent says enchantment on the outside of it. I don't know how much more enchantment it can be.
Could be enchantment.
I agree. It's a little outside of the spirit of the question. And yes, I could have an enchantment. Okay, so Power Leak. There.
Yes!
I'm going to put the enchantment on there and say that my number two is Power Leak. And I don't have that one memorized, but I remember that it is an enchantment and it has something to do with, like, upkeep costs on the enchantment. It's so bizarre.
That sounds like an upkeep cost.
Oh, it's crappy. It is just beyond what any card could be nowadays. No one could ever print something like that now. It's really great. My number three is, since you're still ruminating and thinking on it over there, what's it called? Okay, help me out here. It goes in my Norn the Wary deck.
Okay.
It's red 3. And has something to do with entering the battlefield and exchanging permanent types.
Grip of Chaos?
No, it's not Grip of Chaos, but it is pretty chaotic. It's like...
Let's try and quickly move to the...
Yeah.
Are we going to have to consult you?
No, it's kind of embarrassing that I forgot the name of this card. It's the centerpiece of the whole deck. Confusion in the Ranks.
Confusion in the Ranks.
Now there is an enchantment that I absolutely love playing. Because it gets to be a nightmare trying to resolve what happens if a whole bunch of stuff enters the battlefield all at once.
Yes.
It's like, okay, we set up this tier list of exchanges and you make diagrams, and then when it all settles out, people don't really realize in between steps of the stack whether or not they're going to make it out on top.
Yes.
Never mind how awesome it is to combine Norrin the Wary with Confusion in the Ranks.
That's pretty strong.
The way this works is whenever Norrin enters the battlefield, you can exchange him for any creature. And then they get Norrin and you get their creature. And then whenever anything happens, Norrin leaves the battlefield and comes back on your side.
Whoops.
So... Yeah!
Triggers Confusion again.
Yes.
Whoops.
What happens is, over time... Yeah, okay.
My number three is Parallax Wave.
Okay. That is definitely that is definitely an enchantment.
It cuts many different ways, and it makes me feel smote when I play it.
Cuts right to the bone.
All right, so those are our three favorite enchantments. Two of mine do nothing. One of mine is actually worthwhile.
Yeah. Confusion in the Ranks can often do nothing.
Yes.
Like, if there are no other enchantments on the battlefield, it won't exchange itself for anything. Not that you really mind giving it away, since it kind of globally affects stuff. But, one of them definitely does nothing. Good God, Power Leak.
Yes.
I think I'm throwing that up there for nostalgia more than anything else.
Yes.
All right, so that is Skulls Asked and Skulls Answered. So thank you, listener. Hold on, Juicely, for that question.
Yes. All right.
I'm gonna move it up.
Question two.
Yes, question two comes from Bowser Knight. What do you think of other Magic-style card games? For example, Yu-Gi-Oh.
Oh, so just like other games that are cards and fighting.
Well, I think this is more in the vein of other collectible card games, because that's a distinct thing.
Okay, so collectible card games. As far as I know, they're trash. Yu-Gi-Oh is a solved game, and Pokemon, similarly, at least when I played it, was pretty solved. Then again, so is Magic. Maybe I hate all of them.
How is Magic a solved game?
No, it's not, because you did that thing with your Eldrazi.
Get out of here.
I
said, okay, turn 5, I cast Emrakul, alright? And then I got another turn. Turn 6 was also mine. Or maybe turn 5B, or whatever you want to call it.
Turn 5.5.
Well, I don't know. There's one... I can't remember the name of this, but it comes in little white boxes and has like a goofy symbol that kind of looks like Kingdom Hearts on the outside of it. That one is also a collectible card game, I think, and it's supposed to be pretty good. At least, like, the more strategically minded Magic players that I had heard of had played it and said it was good.
I cannot begin to guess at what you are describing.
Well, if you don't frequent comic shops and other, like, game sellers, then you probably would never have seen the damn thing. It's that kind of obscure. Also, the name of the game is, like, one word, and it's a simple word.
Rage.
So, yeah.
No. That's a different game.
It's some word like tactics, or... exchange, or, you know, one of those little...
Elephant.
Some kind of little strategic word. And that's the name of the game, and it's a collectible card game, and it's pretty good.
Wizards.
From anecdotes that I've heard, knowing absolutely nothing about the game. I mean, the ones that are, like, trying to be fake versions of Magic have been killed off forever by actual Magic. there was a time in Magic's history where TSR, who already was the like big dog in town and had Dungeons and Dragons and all that stuff, they tried to produce their own collectible card game, but for almost insane reasons, it was a total flop. And then everyone forgot about it. Forgot it even existed. Yeah, Spellfire. Yeah. That shit.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I always heard it was just really bad. But I never actually played it.
I never played it either. I hadn't even heard of it until, like, this year when I read an article about how it existed and Magic just destroyed it.
I knew about it from old issues of Inquest where they joke about it.
Oh, harsh.
Back when I was like 11 or 12.
Well, I guess Inquest got their comeuppance too. I don't suppose they still produce that magazine.
No, magazines are dead.
Well, that's not quite the case. Which does bring us, I think that more or less answers our Skulls asked question. Because I guess it's not even...
Yu-Gi-Oh! Has too many codes which are strictly worse versions of other codes. And
I guess that in...
Actually, I've heard modern Pokemon is pretty playable.
The case,
but back when I played, you played one of the three top decks or you lost.
I just haven't played any of the others all that much to be able to form an accurate thought about them myself, but most of them are probably going to be worse than Magic, and Magic is already pretty awful, but for different reasons. No matter what kind of criticisms I have of the game itself, as a game, under its original design and with its like implementation and card art and everything, it's reasonably complete as a game and pretty good. It's the kinds of things that happen to it and the people who play it that make it bad. The game qua the game is pretty good. But magazines being dead, that little mini quote there, and thank you Bowser Knight for the question, leads us into our actual topic for tonight, outside of the segment.
Yes, and that's the Infinite Book Review.
It is. Episode 39, Book Review, Chapter 2. So why don't you start us off with the chapter name.
Ah, Chapter 2, The History of Magic. Wait!
Yes, this is the history of magic, in brief.
But not the kind of magic we were just talking about.
No.
Also, that wait was me, that's not in the title.
I understand that.
Okay. I want to make sure the listeners do.
Very good. So last time we got the overview of the book and the central premise of the argument, which was that games are fundamentally bad, basically, because they're being made by people who don't really care about games. They only care about profits. They're huge companies who are trying to maximize the effect that any given game has on their profit margins, and they currently have pretty hegemonic control over how games get produced and who gets to make them, and they stand as gatekeepers.
Yes.
So tonight we get to learn a little bit more about why that is or why it came to be in the history of games themselves, in brief.
Yes.
So, let's see, we start off by learning more about these, I guess, MIT engineers and scientists who could program computers.
Basically, yeah, back in ye olden days of computing, you were probably writing assembly code, and it takes a certain type of madness to choose to write assembly code, at least in the current year, 2012. But that's what they did back then, and so this is really something that, you know, this was done by the people studying computers.
So if you could, and I think I need a little bit of an explanation about this myself, although I have perhaps somewhat, just slightly better than total layman's understanding of this. Is there a way that you can simplify the distinction between assembly code and some other kind of coding language?
Well, a coding language you may be familiar with is, I guess the best way to put it is that assembly has much fewer instructions and deals more directly with the computer's memory and processor. There are no key, like something like the word if then else. That does not, so much, you know, that sort of exists in assembly as the conditional jump. Whereas in a more modern language, you'd say like if, and then you'd probably have a condition, and then a block of code to execute when that condition is true, possibly with a then, symbol between the condition and that block, and then possibly an else symbol, a block of code to execute when the condition is false. And then probably an end, you know, possibly an end if symbol of some variety. Whereas in assembly, you would instead structure that as a conditional jump, and you can give that, basically, as far as how to actually get that condition, though you'll probably need a few extra instructions if you want anything, complex. There's no concept of the Boolean and, or just sort of nicely chaining things together. Looping becomes harder because basically to do any sort of branching or iteration, you need a go-to and then a target for that go-to statement. Everything is done with go-tos. A lot of the time, and because another thing that you have to do is if you want to be jumping around into, you know, what we call, you know, a function, calling a function is easy in a language like Java or PHP. You have your function, you define your function somewhere and you give it a name and then you just, you write that name and you pass it arguments. Where, well, if you want to do that in assembly, first you need to push all of your arguments onto the stack in reverse order and then push the return address that you want the function to go back to, once it's done. And by return address, I mean where you want your program counter to return to. And then you jump to that address and it will change where your stack pointer and your frame pointer are pointing to, which are two important registers. And then other things can happen. And once you finish your function, you need to take things back off your stack. And I don't know. Now I'm just rambling about computer languages.
Right.
Here's what you need to know.
Writing
about assembly is hard.
Yes, which is actually the salient point, and I'm glad that you mentioned the stack, because what this chapter is all about is that this system of programming anything or making a video game to happen is really, really strange and weird. It doesn't flow like natural language in the least. It is hyper specialized. You have to be the experts of the experts to be able to do this with any kind of alacrity.
You are one step removed from ones and zeros.
Yeah. How about that?
One step.
But I'm really glad that you mentioned the stack, because this whole chapter is about the similarity between the systems of early games and like being about Dungeons and Dragons and spell casting and all that stuff.
Yes.
And how similar their magic systems are to the systems of programming that they used to create the games, and that they understood that they were using that, well, that they were perhaps without even realizing it, pressing their own experiences and own lives into the games that they were making, which is what comes out in art. You know, you experience something and then it's that those themes work their way into what you do, unless you're some kind of bizarre scion or demagogue who can detach oneself from one's own experiences.
Most people love it.
Yeah. The problem, as it were, is that they're pressing this same attitude of really arcane, expert level only, hard to deal with topics into the themes of their games.
Yes.
And that we really are still reeling from that even now.
You know, starting off, that's not a problem.
because the people making the games were also the people consuming the games. So they are experts in all these things that the game creators expect them to be experts in.
That's also not a sustainable thing, and also part of the problem nowadays, where we do want games to be for everyone.
Yes.
I do. I think that's great.
Yes. Games should be for people.
The same way that art should be for everyone.
Yes.
It shouldn't be like the like art people. People who are allowed art and people who are not allowed art. Could you imagine? Actually, I passed a sign on the way back home today. I have passed this sign many times, but I had never taken note of it before. It said, among its various prohibitions, no distribution of literature. Now, this was for, like, a neighborhood.
Yes.
Right? So there, you know, no solicitation, no distribution of literature. What they mean is, don't send your drudge around with a bunch of flyers and stick in everybody's door.
Yes.
But when they just phrase it that way, I'm picturing to myself, oh man, if I get 28 copies of a Charles Dickens novel and leave one on each doorstep, I'm going to be in big trouble.
Oh yeah.
Because I distributed literature.
Oh,
these people belong to the category of those whom art is not for. So that's the scary new world that we're getting towards.
Yes.
But that's the general feel of the chapter, is like how this stuff came to be, the people who made it, how they pressed their own understanding into it, and what they think of magic as.
Yes.
Now, to a couple of more pointed criticisms, if you could call up page 27,
third paragraph.
There's a sentence that contains the phrase indistinguishable from. And I want to call out this sentence.
It's not surprising at all that in a fantasy world constructed by programmers, the power to create and change the world would be indistinguishable from programming.
All right, and I do have a criticism of this. The problem that I have with this book in general, which I don't mind spoiling, is that there are so many general arguments that I accede to and that I believe in and I think are good and necessary for what's going on, and so many, like, little points that I can't let abide. Probably because of my own training. I'm like, okay, this argument is good. You need to do it well. And my criticism here is that the phrase indistinguishable from is not equivalent to similar to. And throughout this passage, we are using them interchangeably, and that's not right. Programming and the magic language of the games are distinguishable because I can understand one of them.
I mean, I too can understand one of them.
If we're talking about Dungeons and Dragons rules, I can eventually parse those, and they're written ultimately in English, and I can get at that. This is distinguishable from assembly code.
Yes.
We just made pains making that distinguishment very pointed.
Although it's sort of, it was a little nostalgic to look at the block of assembly code included in here and be able to sort of read it. Okay, so we're loading this register and then we're adding this register to it and storing it back again. Okay. And it's like, okay, and here we've got a conditional whatever, and like looking back at that, like I couldn't actually tell you what this block of code does.
Yeah, but what we're talking about in that passage is any grammar. Natural language and programming languages share a lot of the same requirements to be complete.
They need a grammar.
Indeed. And presumably Arcana also requires this.
Yes.
And that is not so much of a leap and not necessarily a thing that only programmers do. I mean, if we're saying that both code and natural language need the same thing, then to say, okay, Arcanum also needs this, that doesn't slice it up as only a programmer's toy. And I thought that weakened the argument, which is still a good one, I think, on the whole. So let's see. I'm probably laboring the point a little much, too.
That's fine.
I do get really antsy over people overusing or misusing terms to mean the same thing as things that they really don't mean. This happens in, like, baseball, too. Or any time they say, like, it's a 2-2 tie. What, could it be 2-2 with one team winning? Is that... it's a 2-2 tie.
One step removed from the pin number.
So the
idea here is that certain words have special meaning, and proper knowledge of these words can produce a desirable result.
Yeah, and that's magic.
That is magic as programming, and that's programming as magic.
I think even a more salient example of this is how in your description just a moment ago, you mentioned the stack and having to put things on in reverse order, which is how it works in Magic, the Gathering.
Ah, yes. Although Magic didn't start with that.
Spell stack. But it basically did. It did. All but the word stack. Because we'd still, like, resolve things in reverse order. We just had a couple different ways of timing because there was, like, an interrupt window and fast effects that would go off before other instance and all that. But then they just generalized all of it. They said, okay, there's no more interrupts. Fast effects and instants have the same, like, speed or priority or whatever you want to think about it as. And everything goes on the stack and then resolves in reverse order.
Yes, first in, last
like,
out.
Whoa!
And you tell this to any student of programming, and they will instantly understand what you mean.
Yeah.
It's a stack. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm probably the enemy programmer.
That's probably why they called it that in the first place. They didn't really envision people like stacking up cards, though we do sometimes do that.
Oh yeah.
But no, that itself is a strong example of the kind of stuff that we're talking about. So next, let's call it page 28, paragraph 1, which I think is a better approach to the argument.
Yes. This is talking about the Ultima series. Should I just go for it?
If it's a short enough paragraph, yeah, just go for it.
It's not terribly...
Okay, if it's not a short paragraph, then we'll summarize.
It's basically saying the theme of magic as technology occurred in a bunch of other games, such as the Ultima series, and also multi-user dungeons.
Yes. Okay, so the Ultima games were a Richard Garriott thing, and I actually remember this happening in Exodus, I think, where you get to the end of the game and you find out that the evil force, or like the big villain, is really a robot that you have to reprogram to be good.
Yes.
And the whole game itself is like this high fantasy, elves and dwarves, magic, sorcery, swords, that kind of stuff, but it only introduces the... Hey, you're really in a programming world, and at the end as a twist. And that itself is a conceit to one of the early Dungeons & Dragons modules, whose name escapes me. But it was like the progenitor of all this shit, where you're like in the high fantasy, and then you discover a spaceship that's crashed somewhere and do whatever else. As it turns out, Final Fantasy I was also based on that module. Which is why you have things like War Mech. And why Tiamat's dungeon has some other, like, techno stuff in it.
Ah, yes. Okay, so now that we've established that I am legally a wizard, you can allow me into your home and we can continue our analysis.
As is Richard Garriott.
Yes, he's decidedly a wizard.
The only other thing I meant to mention at that point was that I'm reasonably comfortable to state that we have evolved away from multi-user dungeons as a model for games. The mud is definitely a thing, and its time is definitely past.
They do still exist.
They do? You can still find a mud. You might even find humans in them.
Oh, yes. Some of them are actually popular? Among the mud crab?
Yeah, I think only in relative terms could we ever say that that kind of thing is popular, but we have new technology. There are plenty of throwbacks. There are even throwback games that get modern styling and have design principles that are stuck in, like, the early 1990s. I'm looking at you, La Mulana. It's indistinguishable from Metroid 1 in my sight, which is also, if I'm honest, not a very good game if you don't know exactly where to go. Even a questionable game if you do.
World of Warcraft is a mud with some nice graphics on top and a lot of voice acting.
It's fundamentally different. It is. Come on.
I don't know.
You're throwing out every design principle that has happened between MUDs and World of Warcraft and saying, okay, all this shit doesn't really fucking mean anything.
What I'm saying is that you can see a lot of similarities between ye old MUDs and World of Warcraft. That
you can
still,
at,
they do have a lot in common.
You can at best use one as an analogy for the other. But I would by no means say that we can bundle them together as the same thing. That whole
But I think it would be funny if we could.
It would be pretty fucking hilarious. Actually, if we could make some kind of like interface that stripped away all the graphics and just had you play a MUD but you were still playing World of Warcraft and called it like what do they call those? They actually have little add-ins that you can do to like create more graphics and shit.
It's a mod? They just have, like, mods.
Do they just call them mods?
Mod.
I thought they called them something else.
I don't know.
Maybe
it
is mod. Anyway, yeah. We could make the WoW mud mod.
Yeah. Play the game entirely from command line, as God intended.
I think I would have to install something to run a command line on my thing. I mean, really. I don't consider them the same thing, and I do think the intervening years have brought us a lot of design advantages, in particular how to teach. That's gotten way, way better. All right, but we'll move on. There was another little phrase, quote, means of creating. This is page 28, paragraph 2. I found this to be platitudinous. I didn't think it was very useful to the argument. So, like, what the means of creating? It's like, whoa, okay, we're suddenly in this, like, heady, philosophical, concept-level stuff. We're talking about, like, Marxist doctrine and the, like, who owns capital and the means of production.
I own the means of production.
Yeah.
I'm the wizard. Only I can make magic.
So I thought that phrasing was platitudinous and not all that great, but the argument is pretty good. So we have our first mention of attract mode on page 28, paragraph 4.
I love
4.
Attract mode.
Right, and that's a throwback to Carnival Barkers and games. Even some games nowadays have that. I think that, I mean, certainly in like Super Nintendo era, all games had this where, you know, it had the start screen and then it would cycle through little snapshots of the game to keep you interested. But it was on a home console. You never needed that. No one ever made a... I probably shouldn't say no one ever, but no one ever commercially produced, there we go, a Chrono Trigger, like, stand-up arcade machine that needed an attract mode. That was too.
I did once
you to,
in
like,
my youth
come over
go
here
to,
and spend your money.
Go to a little, I guess, store? Question mark. That was essentially an arcade, but with a whole lot of console setups, and you paid for just time on the machines.
That is truly bizarre.
And so they did. The attract mode is suddenly relevant on the Super Nintendo. Not actually, though.
Yeah, I mean.
At that point, games were still heavily influenced.
This was actually a really. I wish that I could remember more about this experience because I didn't know that I was going to this place when we left. I thought I was just gonna like go on like an outing with one of my neighborhood friends, right? But we left in his, you know, I thought I was going to like hang out at his house or whatever. But we left in his mom's car. She took us to a friend of theirs who had a converted barn that had a whole bunch of arcade machines in it. And they were all free. Nuts.
Oh, yeah.
So you just had free play on everything in this huge barn that was full of arcade machines. And I was baffled. I'm like, whoa! It was so cool. I played Galaga.
Yeah.
And Centipede.
Yes.
I remember doing Centipede. I played Frogger.
I'm not such a fan of Frogger.
Well, it's a classic, though.
It is. I acknowledge its role in history.
I probably played Space Invaders as well, but talking about the kind of classicism that this was. And, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I had a Nintendo Entertainment System at home. This stuff had been out for years. There's one of those cocktail Pac-Man tables They're so cool, by the way. This was a throwback even then, but I loved the hell out of it. I mean, because it was free play on all these games, but
you feel rich.
There was still something else about it where the games had some craftsmanship to them. They were designed with the intent of fun and achieving a score in mind, you know? And
yes, high score. At the top of the screen is always high score, and you want your score to be there.
Yeah, damn right. And then you could put your initials on there.
In later games, you could enter initials to prove it was you.
Yeah. Your initials were ASS, almost always. Although Capcom got clever about that. If you put in some of the known lascivious things or lazy things, if you just mashed A, it would put in COM for...
Yes.
Or CAP, I guess. I forget what it would put in, but it would replace those.
Yes.
All right, moving on to...
Arcade machines.
Attract mode. Yeah, that's the conversion, and we're sort of getting away from engineers into marketing games. And attract mode was a way for games to market themselves.
Yes.
Basically, because, you know, they don't have agreed upon or known rules to them. Each game is its own set of rules, and you just have to be familiar with it in order to play it. You know, how many squares high your character can jump, even if you know that it's a platformer game, that bit of knowledge is often the difference between whether or not you will enjoy the game. Can I make that jump or not? And if you can't know, then, you know, you just...
You're gonna hate it.
Yeah.
You're gonna get mad, you're gonna play something else.
Darn right. Alright, page 29, paragraph 1. The other half of this equation of, like, arcade games was also bar arcade machines.
Yes.
And originally they were the same thing, but they've taken a different evolutionary track, and you can still find these things in bars and other, I guess, restaurants, but probably also restaurants with bars. And they always, like, sit on top of the bar, and it looks like an old television screen or whatever, and it says, like, video poker, or just that has some stupid name to it, and involves matching balls, and
a whole bunch of little flash games on
it. Yeah, it has an attract mode, but the attract mode fails to explain precisely what you're doing, and it's obvious that they kind of want to really be a casino game.
Yeah,
but they shy
away
from
legally
it.
Do it.
Yeah.
No
but
rules
that's,
about that.
That's the current evolution of the bar video game, and it is a different one from the way
that you got Golden Tee.
I'm sorry, what?
You have the Golden Tee.
Golden Tee?
Yeah, it's that golf game.
That's
always, they'll have two machines in the bar, they'll also have like the deer hunting game.
Yeah, well.
Those are the games that still exist in bars.
I guess if you go a little south from us, sure.
Not too far south. I ran into one at work the other day.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
This place continues to surprise me, man. We get all kinds of people up here.
Fascinating.
But that's the bar version of the evolution of those games, and it is different, and it's basically an evolutionary dead end. No one should design those games. They're awful. All right, page 29, paragraph 3, quote, stranglehold. We get a a little taste, another mention of business and capital being the problem in this whole equation, and that's the part that's central to all this that I kind of cling to.
Yes. Business people gain their foothold, soon to be stranglehold.
Yes. Yeah, but modernly it definitely is a stranglehold. There's no getting past the fact that the big publishers have established themselves as gatekeepers. That's real. We live in that age. Page 31, paragraph 1. Arcades are still big in Japan. By and large, arcades have been closing down in America, so that we don't have that same need for attract mode in the same sense of, like, carnival barkers and, hey, come play this, come spend your money on this, you'll have fun. But somehow it still works over there. I don't know.
From my admittedly limited knowledge, just from talking to people who have been there, who live there, it's viewed as a just more social thing, and it's viewed as something that anyone can do just after work, you know, spend a little time at the arcade, that's okay. You know, you see, like, 40-year-old businessmen going for a couple rounds of Street Fighter after work. That's just accepted, and it's a place for people to gather, and compete, in a lot of cases, at least in the case of things like fighting games or dance games. But it just seems like the whole social aspect of it, is what keeps it strong, and that did exist in American arcades. But America's a just in general a much more spread out country than Japan is.
Yeah.
So arcades continued to thrive in America in places like New York City, where people are all together. Or, you know,
Yeah, that's probably it. Just by itself.
Yes.
Because we do have a lot of space in America, and we do have, like, front yards and large rooms in our houses and stuff, and we don't have a central way of getting to arcades. I mean, the last time I saw an arcade, it was in, like, a mall, right?
Yes.
But even malls are getting less popular, because we can buy stuff online nowadays.
Yes. Malls need some amazingness to them to get us to go there. Well, they need to sell us something that we don't want to buy online.
Hmm. Yeah, that is interesting that it stays alive over there.
If someone with more understanding on this could weigh in the comments, perhaps we'd appreciate it. But my understanding is that it's just different culture.
Well, fair enough. They still have their own set of publishers and gatekeepers, though.
They do.
That doesn't allow them to escape the big problem.
Yes.
All right. So. Page 33, paragraph 3, a little excerpt there. Computers aren't homogeneous or homogenous.
Yes.
There's one company who tries to make them homogenous.
Yes.
And to a degree, they have succeeded. That's the Apple computer.
Yes.
You know, that's their whole thing. Our stuff just works. You don't have to worry about hardware and software not working together. That's something that a Mac can absolutely guarantee.
Usually.
Until it doesn't. Take it to the Mac store.
Yeah.
The Apple
store. But yes, they are much more homogeneous pieces of hardware.
Yeah.
Not to the degree that a game console is.
Right.
But
really,
they're
average
Windows.
I mean, if anything,
box.
that's the exception that proves the rule.
Yes.
So, let's see. Page 34, paragraph 2 spells out the developer-publisher relationship. We're finally to the point in history where, like, we need publishing houses and development studios. Publishing houses because the physical stuff that games are printed on is costly and difficult to make.
Yes. At first the cartridge, now onto optical media. But back in the days of the cartridges were expensive to produce. And so that was a real part of the cost of getting a game into people's homes.
Yeah. And it still is. We still do make discs.
Yes.
How about
They're
that?
Much less expensive than the cartridges, but I suppose still must have some cost.
Yeah, well, I mean, any asshole nowadays can burn a CD or DVD, but yes. It's a fancy asshole who can burn a Blu-ray disc.
That's true. PlayStation Triple using Blu-rays is sort of its own special magic.
Yeah, and there's always been a difference between the CDs that you can burn at home and the CDs that get made by professionals. And I don't think that distinguishing feature is going to go away anytime soon.
No.
We have similar tools. We do not have professional tools.
Correct.
So, that leads us to the creativity creation continuum, because we have DevPub as a model. And where the people doing the creating are now further and further removed from the actual creative process. This is like how movie making happens. You have a big publishing studio who signs on for a project and funds the developing house or the directing house or whatever, which is why there's all these like little teases at the beginning of movies that says like, okay, the publisher's logo and little tease, and then the studio, their little logo or tease. This is also why video game development companies call themselves studios, because they want to be like Hollywood. They actively want this model. Certainly the publishers do, because it's keeping them in profits. And the developers, as is too many times the case, just get used and then kicked aside. Okay, you know, good job with your 3 straight weeks of 14-hour, 7 days. We have your game, and now you're all fired.
Yes. We'll put out a hiring call when we get to work on the next game.
Yeah, I think that in that sense, it's more formalized in Hollywood and like movie making, because they know that the studio is only in operation for the duration of the project. They sort of have that implicitly stated, so it's not as exploitative. And yet, tell any drudge working for a Hollywood studio or something, where they have to like move couches and cameras around, and that's their whole job, just doing exactly what they're told for 14 hours a day. Well, tell them it's not exploitative.
Yeah.
I'm not terribly thrilled about Hollywood movies and their model either. It produces Drek like Transformers. 3.
There were 3 of them.
Could you imagine? Anyway, page 37, paragraph 2 simply has a fascinating statement that is not a quote, actually. I was about to quote something, but then I don't want to put words where they don't belong. The idea of games that play themselves.
Yes.
I mean, I reject this out of hand. I take as definition one of the defining features of a game is the fact that there is a player. A game that plays itself is just it's a model. It's a simulation. It's not a game anymore. I mean, I can throw a bunch of Quake bots in the arena and watch them go, but you know, I'm doing the viewing. The art is between me and the experience, so it's not like the bots experience the game at all. But it is
certainly not in the way a human does.
It's fascinating as an idea, though. So I wanted to make note of that.
But certainly a game in which you
you know, perhaps choose a set of instructions for your player avatar, whatever it happens to be, and then deploy it into a world and observe how your set of instructions, you know, what results that have, and then perhaps play again with a new set of instructions. I can call that a valid game.
Hmm. I think it all depends on how far removed we are from input and output. I mean, we can have games where I press a button and something immediately happens on the screen, right? And I'm in direct control of the little avatar and it goes. You know, that's Mega Man. I can play a game where I press a button and there's a little delay and then something happens on the screen, like any whipping Castlevania game, where there's that little bit of tension from the time between I press and when the whip comes out, and I have to learn that timing and plan around it. Then we have the level of removal where you have a couple of party members and you can issue them general orders, and what happens in a combat takes place based on your general orders, but each of them is executing its prefabricated notion of what that is, and you can design parties. That's something like Ogre Battle, and that's still a game. And then we have the level where you set the whole simulation up beforehand and then let it go, and you have no more interaction with the game at all and can just observe what happens until it ends. And that's something like Sim Life. I think you can still intervene in Sim Life, though.
Yes.
Jeez.
I also cannot think of an example of that offhand.
I don't think that's an accident, but I would accept it.
Like, the closest thing I can think of is the game Tory Bash, which is a sort of interesting take on the idea of a fighting game, where combat between two essentially humanoid opponents takes place in very small time intervals. And what happens is, you know, the two players start in their starting positions. You tell your fighter which muscles to tighten or which to contract or loosen in order to create a certain movement. And so you say, you know, okay, contract, you know, this leg muscle and this leg muscle because I want you to throw a kick or whatever. And so you say, do that. And then once each player has put in those commands, a time slice plays out operating under those commands.
Okay, but that's still not separating the player from the game. They're still making those inputs right there, and then the phase where stuff happens, and then they get a phase to do input again.
Yes. Yes.
So it's not a... They don't make the entire plan in the first place and watch it play out. They yes. do have
But I think if they
input.
Did, it would still be a game.
I don't know.
If you
I think at that point, we
like
are...
5 seconds of your fighter operating. It would be a very different game, certainly. But it would,
no,
by my admission, be a game.
I do think at that point, we are far enough away from... player input to output that we can no longer call it a game, and we do call it a simulation. Mm. It's not all that important, though. We're nowhere near games that play themselves, but I
also
did think it was
also somewhat pleased that the example she calls out was also something I did as my senior project in high school.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, I made a little genetic simulation. That's not important. What is important is, again... continuing on to the idea of giving the history of game distribution, talking about the shareware, where essentially game demos are passed around for free, and the full versions are ordered. Usually, you send your money somewhere and you receive physical media in the mail.
Yeah, shareware was weird, man. I never mailed anything to anybody.
No. I never had money, because I was a small child during the era of shareware.
The only shareware stuff that I had was stuff that my friends had, like, already cracked, and the designer didn't care about anymore. He's like, whatever.
Yeah.
Or, like, a lot of them had this, like, donate if you feel like it, and this is the complete thing anyway.
Yeah, donate wear, beware, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Those sort of licenses for software.
But, of course, nowadays we have things like the Xbox Live Arcade and Steam and Diablo 3, where...
And just, yeah, just straight-up websites with files on them.
The big-name companies are already hip on this idea. This is not a vector where the Zinesters can take over. The corporations have already done it better. they're there.
But maybe that's okay.
I think this is still, yes, our ultimate answer, our distribution. I mean, something like Newgrounds also exists. Also, I guess the Apple Store, but I don't like them all that much.
No.
I have to admit that
you
they
don't.
Exist.
That's okay.
I can't get around the fact that they exist. I just don't like them. I mean, you know, still host my podcast and everything. Just saying.
Yes, please don't take this down.
I don't think that anybody who's, like, sampling our cast is going to get 39 episodes in. Be a rather long sample.
It's at random.
Matt.
We're doomed.
Oh, man. It's the most recent one. Oh, crap. But, I mean, my big point with this is that Anaanthropy at this point is really pushing rapid distribution, low-level distribution, file hosting, file sharing as the method that Zinesters can use to create games and exchange games and establish themselves and start to take back the power, for lack of a better word, from the big names. My counter to that is that the big names and big publishers have already done this, and they are there.
They're there.
Downloaded Diablo 3. I did.
Yes.
I decided to buy it, went to the internet, and bought it. I didn't have to move from the comfort of my hyper-comfortable chair.
It's too comfortable for any normal human.
Oh, well, it's perfectly shaped for my Calipigian body, so...
Can we say that word in a podcast?
You can definitely say Calipigian in a podcast. As a matter of fact, I'm making it one of the tags.
Yikes.
Yes. Hotness.
The important thing is that, whereas in... The reason why this is a good vector for the Zinester is because it is inexpensive and sometimes outright free to do this.
Yeah,
For online distribution.
There's not a barrier to entry the same way there is a gate being kept by the big publisher.
You do not need to press a physical disc that will then appear in a physical store. Because that costs a lot, and that cost keeps people out.
Mm.
And we have eliminated the need for this cost, thereby we are not... We
okay,
are no
so there's a bit, at page 39, paragraph 2, quote, consider how many have found, end quote. I don't know exactly the slice that I was getting from this, but how many have found what? Could you read out that sentence for me?
Consider how many... have found. Page 39?
Yeah.
I'm not seeing that words on here.
Oh, that's weird. Paragraph 2? Maybe I wrote down the wrong page number?
Yeah, I mean...
Well, anyway, the point was
anyway.
That I meant to add, I think the sentence was something like, consider how many have found this vector to be an acceptable source of file sharing, whatever. And, to which I ask, well, how many? Is crowdsourced, faux-juried crap worth the effort? Will adding standards to crowdsourced, faux-juried crap actually help at all? This is what gave us Vimeo in place of YouTube. So the question here is Vimeo worth it?
Offhand, no.
Yeah, I mean, I delight in saying no, but there are people who like Vimeo for whatever reason.
It's okay, you can be wrong.
Yeah, well, I think, importantly, Vimeo is not for us, you and
it's
I.
It's for artists.
Yeah, which we're technically not.
I really regret that.
Like we decided before, there are people that art is not for. That's important.
Yes.
Wait. Now I'm confused.
What's this? Backtracking? No. Honestly, I don't think that Vimeo is worth it for what we're talking about here.
Yes.
And if we're going to jury anything, then I hesitate to make this comparison, but let it ride in the free market. The people will buy or not buy what is good or not good.
Well,
God, I want to almost.
We know that's false because Call of Duty exists and has outsold the Super Mario Brothers. But that is, I think, more fair than some elite-appointed jury that chooses what lives and what dies.
Yeah.
It is...
Honestly...
It's like democracy!
No. I kind of like this idea now. I'm coming around to it. If we could do something like Vimeo, but better, where people who really do understand the needs of games can oversee or like help out youngerlings. And I'm thinking this can happen from like either worn out, burned out, out of work, put in their 5 years and then fired developers.
Out of work.
Where they, you know, they do understand the necessities of game design because they were living it for a while.
Yes.
And then they can come around and not directly work on games because that would drive them to madness because they had put in too much work already, but to impart their knowledge on the next generation and serve on these.
So Vimeo, except based on inclusivity rather than exclusivity.
Yes. I think that can work. I'm excited for
come
that.
Come to
idea,
us. We will help you improve your craft. Other than saying, leave if we do not like your craft.
I thought for certain that you were going to say crap there. Your craft!
No, this is a family-friendly podcast.
This hot, steaming pile of craftsmanship. Craftspersonship. We don't want to exclude people.
I mean, like, I have my own web space. I just put my shit there. Family-friendly podcast.
Mm. Oh, we're well beyond it. I made sure to include the check mark where we say explicit content. We're covered for that.
Okay.
We're explicit.
Well, I'm usually explicit. Speaking of which, looking at page 41 where we get our nice little inform 7 code block.
Hmm.
I think this is where I can firmly state this tool is not for me.
Okay. No, that's fair. I remember that little block, and I do have a note on it, page 41.
Yes.
I think this is diluted. Inform is not the answer. This is a method of turning, we're going from English to code that resembles English.
Yeah, this is...
That's madness.
This is, I mean, to me, as a person who likes code, this is unnecessarily ambiguous and verbose.
And to me, as someone who enjoys natural language and occasionally speaks it, this is nightmarish. Because these sentences sound like word salad and I can't read them without laughing my head off. If you're actually gonna go through, like, enough training or whatever to be able to understand this coding language, you will be able to understand another coding language even better. And it won't be as verbose and nonsensical seeming. I think we actually run a risk by doing this. It is important to distinguish languages in your mind. You don't want to slip between your sentences into suddenly talking in another language, for instance. You keep them casually separated so that that kind of slip does not happen. C'est gol comme ça.
What?
It's very important.
I got confused.
But we did. Ugh. I do not like inform. That was.
No.
That was nightmarish.
So this idea that it was made with the idea that an interactive story should be as easy to write as a prose story. That's the idea. I'm going to have to give it an A for effort.
I would give it a different level for effort.
Maybe a slightly different grade for execution.
Okay.
But the point that I think Anna is trying to make here is that coding languages are an extra thing that had to be learned. And not everyone is going to be good at learning that, or wants to take the time, or has the time to learn that, so it would be good. You know, Inform 7 may, in my opinion, not be good, but there certainly can and should be tools that allow someone without a familiarity in programming languages to create, I guess, electronic game software.
Yeah. I think that this example is only good as an analogy, really.
Yes.
It's like, okay, by the way, this is a clay pot. You know, you're not going to make this. We need you to build other things out of clay, but this is what it looks like now it's made. I have to get over the fact that it is so frightfully deluded to think of code that way, and appreciate the fact that nowadays, and increasingly and onward, we're going to have tools where you don't need to know code quite so much to be able to make a game. For example, the StarCraft map creator, map editor. I used that tool back in the day, back in Brood War. I made games in StarCraft.
Games that were not themselves StarCraft.
They may have included elements frightfully similar to StarCraft, but they were not themselves StarCraft. Yes, they were games. There was even, this was a really awesome thing. I'll see if I can dig up a link to it. There was one of the like in-house Battle.net people or Blizzard people had created a game using the map creator in StarCraft. That was Tetris.
Yes, I've heard about that. I've also heard of, in Legend, Tassadar Teaches Typing.
Outstanding.
Whose function you can likely divine from its title alone.
Okay.
Tararatun.
Last bit, there's, let's see.
Something, 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 tools for non-wizards.
Okay, there's a subtext of only here. Okay, page 42, paragraph 2.
Yes.
I noted down that there's a subtext of only that undermines the argument. The difference between, quote, a different and a completely different thing is, that is a difference, and I think the, if I were building this argument, I would omit the words a completely different whatever. I accept a different, I don't accept a completely different. And that's, again, more of my, like, nitpicking, and I think this could be better stated. Of course, I don't have the precise paragraph in front of me to be able to, like, read out. But.
Well, I think at this point, perhaps your notes are failing you, because I'm not seeing any of the things you're referring to.
Okay, I could not have possibly whiffed on two in a row. I'm going to have to look at this book again.
What we're saying here is that imagine a world, Kaz, where magic exists. And
I'm too sore over my notes. That was an important fucking point. Bah!
Imagine a world, Kaz, where magic exists. And I am a person who can do magic. And some people cannot. And so I get a special word to describe me, and that word is wizard. I am a wizard. Some people are wizards. This is a fact about our world of magic. But if all people can use magic, not necessarily always to the same degree, then that word wizard, as it has meaning in our first world, loses meaning. If a wizard is merely one who can perform magic, and all people can perform magic, and all people are wizards, we have no need for the word wizard. Or at least for it to mean that. It can mean something else. It could mean someone with an in-depth knowledge of magic, or someone who knows an exceptionally large or powerful amount of magic.
Well, I'm going to repurpose your argument a little bit here.
To destroy all wizards.
I want wizards to create magic items so that I can also cast spells with them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I want the magic wand, as it were, or rod, yes, or perhaps boots.
Also, you should not need to make a skill check, or at least not a hard one, to use this magic item.
Well,
to do your own magic.
I'm not opposed to learning a skill.
But it shouldn't be so high that large segments of player characters are kept from using these items.
Yeah.
This is a terrible analogy at this point, and I forget where I was going, because this actually came up when I was very upset at my job.
Way too extended. We did get the brief history of magic, though.
Brief history of magic.
Yes.
Programmers as wizards. Programmers, much like wizards, should never be trusted.
Yeah. Never trust a wizard as far as you can throw their skulls.
Skulls.